Jay Perini is a poet, novelist, and professor of English at Middlebury College. He is also the author of several biographies, including Gore Vidal, Empire of Self. This is Jay Perini. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right, I'm here with Jay Perini. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Duncan, I'm glad to be here with you.
So you most recently released a book called Borges and Me. And when I first got my hands on it, I was, it's kind of an amazing story. You were a very young guy and you met this literary legend. Can you describe how that encounter came to be?
Yeah, I was basically just turned 22. And I was starting off as a grad student at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I was kind of in flight from the Vietnam War. I was getting letters from my draft board. I wanted to be out of the country, as far away in a hidden place as possible. And I was trying to get a PhD thesis, go cooking along. And through a tutor, I ran into the Scottish poet, Alastair Reid, who became a very close friend and mentor. And I would spend a lot of time at Alastair's cottage on the North Sea, working on my poems with him. I was writing poetry and he was helping me to write the poems. And we had amazing literary conversations. And I was quite amazed by his whole world. And then one day he said, I've got a visiting friend who's a writer coming from Argentina, Jorge Luis Borges. I'd never heard of him. And Borges arrived. He was old and blind and seemed very strange to me. And then Alistair had to go to London and said, would I mind babysitting Borges for a few days? And so when Alistair left, he left me in charge of old Borges, who immediately said he wanted to visit, he needed to get as soon as possible to visit somebody up in Inverness. And he knew I had a car. He said, would I drive him? He said, I've always longed to see the Highlands as well. I said, but Borges, you're blind. He said, oh no, Jay, don't tell me you're blind as well. Okay. He said, no, I'm not blind. And so we took off for the Highlands. And this was like an amazing trip for just less than under a week. It was really only 4 days. We traveled around the Highlands of Scotland in my little tiny beaten up 1957 Morris Minor, just the two of us, which Borges christened Rocinante after the lame horse of Don Quixote. And he called me Giuseppe after Giuseppe Parini, the poet, or sometimes he called me Sancho after Sancho Panza, the sidekick of Don Quixote. Oh, man. And we had some adventures on the road, and these became the basis for this memoir, which I never thought I would have thought of this as a book, but a couple of years ago, a friend was listening to me tell these stories and said, you know, you better write that down quickly. It would make a wonderful movie. So, and he's a film director. So I said, I'm going to do that. So I wrote it and again, it poured out really probably in 4, 5, 6 months. I wrote the whole book.
At that age, were you able to realize how big of a deal this was?
Oh God, no, I had no idea who Borges was, as I said.
Yeah.
Although as we traveled, it quickly dawned on me that this guy was remarkable and had an encyclopedic knowledge of literature and had a most adventurous and winsome way of talking about life and literature and ideas.
How so? I know you talk about how he taught himself Anglo-Saxon and so on, and being in the Highlands, it seems like that would all be very relevant, no?
Yeah, he would be endlessly quoting Beowulf and the Seafarer in Anglo-Saxon from memory. He had vast patches of Anglo-Saxon poetry memorized. He had vast patches of English poetry memorized. He would recite long passages from Shakespeare and Robert Louis Stevenson and G.K. Chesterton and Kipling and a range of other poets, and even long prose passages. I was quite startled by his flypaper memory and how he seemed to know everything. He told me he had been the librarian in chief at the university for the country of Argentina. And I believed it. He said seemed to have read everything. It was quite extraordinary being around him.
Did you, over the course of that week, did you become better acquainted with either his work or his reputation, at least?
Not really. Not till I got back. Although by the time I finished my travels with him, I realized he was an important writer because he mentioned there are certain things caught my attention. He told me he was about to get an honorary degree at Oxford. And I thought, well, he must be something important. So, but I didn't really know about his, didn't know what it all meant. You know, when we stopped the first night in a pub in a place called Lower Largo at the Robinson Crusoe Inn, went into the bar with him and sat him down. And I said, Borges, can I get you something? He said, yes, I want typical Scottish beer. And I went off and got him a pint of export, it was called, and brought it back. And he stuck his finger into the beer and swirled it around and licked his finger. And I'm a little OCD. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a very long week.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, Borges, Alistair tells me that you are a writer. I said, oh, Alistair, he's always exaggerating. I said, so you're not a writer? He said, oh, Jay, I write only these tiny stories, some of them only one paragraph long. So I was getting very dismissive. I said, well, how many novels have you written, Borges? None. I said, oh my God, did you never want to write a novel? He said, want? My dear boy, my whole life, I dreamed of writing the great novel of the Pampas. There would be gauchos and prostitutes and wars, and generations would rise and fall, and there would be matricide and fratricide and patricide. I said, oh my God. I said, and he said, it would be 1,000 pages long. I said, well, what happened, Borges? He said, well, 1, 2, 3, 4 decades passed, and I never wrote this book. But one morning, dear boy, I woke up, Giuseppe, and I went to my desk, and I wrote down a 200-word review of this novel, and that satisfied the impulse.
Wow.
So that was the kind of thing that he was saying to me, and like and other things stuck in my mind. Like, I remember he was talking on about the greatest narrator is Scheherazade from 1001 Nights, the Arabian Tales, Nights. And I said to him, who wrote that, Borges? And he said, who wrote the Arabian Nights? He said, hey, I did. I wrote all the classics. And it's annoyed me. He said, it's annoyed my contemporaries to no end. My mind was spinning from this conversation with Borges.
That is almost so on the nose of what you would expect, that it's hilarious to me that you had no idea going into this who this guy was. And yeah. You talk about in the book, his personality was very, he seemed very open to people, and he definitely does not come across as a snob. Was that personality trait of someone who was of his stature, and you've known some great writers, was that personality trait unusual, you think?
You know, I think my feeling is that the greater the writer, the more open and less snobby they are. You know, if a person is very snobby, like say Gore Vidal, it means they're very well defended. And you know what I mean by that in a psychological sense.
Right.
And it means that there are limitations that are going to damage them as a writer. So, you know, the greatest writers I've known, Borges, Graham Greene, a few others, just seem to me very ordinary and open.
What was Graham Greene like?
Graham Greene was tremendously friendly to me, open, cheerful, talk about anything. There was just simply no sides to him. He was not shy about talking about his work or his travels. I met him on the island of Capri in the mid 80s. And then we went down to, then he invited me over to his house in, where was it? Antibes in the south of France. I spent a week over there with him, and it was quite extraordinary. I loved Graham Greene, and I loved his work too. I mean, Graham Greene is a truly great writer. I mean, if you think I'm kidding, read The Heart of the Matter. Every page is like a poem.
Do you think that he's one of those guys who's kind of, he definitely hasn't passed into obscurity, but his reputation does not necessarily match the work?
I mean, it's nobody's written your reputation ever survives for too long, but it seems. But you know, because there are so many movies always of his work, such as you know, The Quiet American wasn't too long ago, a great movie. There was another great movie not that long ago of The End of the Affair. So I think cinema sometimes keeps these writers alive, and I think Graham Greene is one of those writers that will persist in time because there are half a dozen classic novels that are really among the best novels of the 20th century to read.
And when you mentioned Vidal in there, and I definitely want to talk about him.
Yeah.
And it's curious to me, and I wanted to know why you wrote a book about him, especially relative to some of the other writers that you've written about.
I knew him so damn well. You know, he was a very close friend of mine, and I knew him extremely well over 30 years. We talked on the phone every week for 30 years, and I visited him a lot and spent a lot of time with him. We traveled together. We traveled in England and in Austria and all over the US and, you know, you name it. We traveled. So I knew Gore very, very well. And, you know, he was a fascinating man, and he was, you know, one of the great essayists of all time. So, and he was an incredibly interesting mind to be around. He was sharp. He was, you know, he was difficult. He was kind of like an Oscar Wilde figure. He was dropping one-liners. He was a very entertaining companion.
Well, that's something that Christopher Hitchens once says, that he was the closest we've come to like an Oscar Wilde in America. But there was, sorry, go ahead.
That's just true. I think he was a kind of Oscar Wildean figure. Very, very self-consciously doing that too, you know.
Do you think that was an act?
Oh yeah, it was a big act, but it was, you know, a good act. And Gore was a good actor. And I think it was a good act. His biggest role was Gore Vidal, you know, and he would say very witty and funny things. I don't know. I mean, it's amazing to me how we would come up with these things.
And was he like that over the phone, in person as well, or did
always? Yeah. The act very rarely let down, and he was like that over the phone. You know, we would talk. It would be 3 a.m. He'd be talking, and he would be like that. And I'd be staying with him, and we'd be talking all night long. And he was never, you know, he'd get very, very drunk. He was a massively alcoholic man, and he would get drunk. And you know, he's always like he always was. Gore was Gore.
Even when he was massively drunk, he would still be witty or charming.
He would. I mean, I think the charm started to erode after the 15th glass of whiskey. But yes. Yes, once I was sitting there with him late on at the villa in Italy, and with his boyfriend Howard and Gore. And Gore had been carrying on about Norman Mailer, whom he hated all night long. And finally he said to me, Jay, he was drinking scotch in a big glass. He'd probably finished off the full bottle that night. He said, Jay, you've been very quiet tonight. What do you think about Mailer? I said, well, you know, I basically agree with you, Gore, that most of his books are failures, but you must admit, The Naked and the Dead is really one of the great novels of the Pacific War in World War II. He said, one of the great novels of the Pacific War. And he looked at me, and then he suddenly hurled the glass of whiskey right at my head. Barely ducked, and it skimmed over my head, and the glass smashed against the wall. And Howard was aghast, and Howard said, Gore, that was Irish Crystal.
Whoa.
So that was quite a night. But, you know, I had some events, some encounters with Gore Vidal, shall we say.
So that description, that is a very, that's a violent act, throwing a glass against someone's head. Like that could seriously hurt you.
Well, it could have. I'm glad he missed, but he was so drunk, it was hard to throw straight. And he probably aimed it slightly above my head.
How do you remain friends with a guy who's that, unpredictable?
Well, he was always unpredictable like that. And, you know, there were pluses and minuses, and, you know, I liked him basically. And, I was interested in him, and I felt like I got something out of it. And the end of the day, I think I I might have been mistaken. It was exhausting. Writing the book was extremely exhausting. Writing the biography of Gore really.
Why is that?
I don't know. I just found reliving it all was kind of, was very, very exhausting to me, because I realized, you know, I put up with a lot of shit for 30 years, and got a lot out of it, but there was a lot of crap there. And I learned a lot from the guy, but, you know, at a price. It was extremely expensive tuition, shall we say. And I paid it. And then I wrote the movie about Gore, which we shot in Italy at Gore's Villa, 2017, with Kevin Spacey playing Gore Vidal. It was quite, so that was an experience. I mean, this thing led to many experiences.
Yeah. How, the movie that was made, because there was another a documentary, Best of Enemies, that
Best of Enemies, and then there's a good documentary, which I think is better, called Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm a talking head in that one. And but the movie I did about Gore with Michael Hoffman is a fictional movie about Gore Vidal. It's a biopic. Was a Netflix biopic starring Kevin Spacey, which has yet to be released.
I was going to say, so that's, is that on the you know, coming soon?
I think it'll eventually come out, but because Kevin Spacey again has been so.
Oh yes, of course.
Kevin's had his problems, and Kevin's Netflix has been hesitant to let it fly into the public eye.
I can imagine
at the moment. So I don't know what it'll eventually come out. But I mean, it's hard to shut down a brilliant, it is a wonderful movie. It's beautifully acted, great actors in it. And I think it's very witty and fun. And it's a beautiful physical movie to look at, set in Italy. And I think that it will eventually come out, but it just might take a while.
Wow. That's how disappointed were you? I mean, not just the gas.
Massively disappointed. I spent 3 months making this movie there. I was behind the camera for every single take, and closely involved with the cast and the crew and the director and the producer, who are friends. So it was a joint effort, and we were very disappointed that we couldn't just bring it out on Netflix.
Well, here's something I'm curious about, because writing, and you've written, you know, novels, poems, biographies. It's such a, at the end of the day, it's just you putting words on the page. Whereas filmmaking is so collaborative. Was that an unsettling experience at all? Did you take
it? Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I did it once before. I worked on The Last Station, my novel about the last days of Tolstoy, which was made into an Academy Award nominated film with Helen Mirren and Christopher Plummer and James McAvoy and Paul Giamatti. And so I had years working on that film, years and years. And that had many ups and downs, but finally it came out and was very good. And then I had the experience of the Vidal film with that terrible conclusion. Right. Hopefully it will one day come out. And I'm in the midst of, I'm in the midst of three or four other films right now.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Do you have any news to break there?
Not really. I'm just working on them, and I'm in all three of them are really close to being, the scripts are basically almost there.
Well, you know, something you mentioned earlier that I just remembered I wanted to pick up on is Gore's guardedness as a person. And you talked about how that greater openness in some ways runs in tandem with being a greater writer. And I had talked to a biographer of Hemingway, who he was kind of a perfect example of a guy who probably his personality traits stunted his psychological growth, but also his growth as a writer. In Gore's case, what was the hang up?
Well, you know, Gore's endless chip on his shoulder about being gay, his defendedness about not having gone to college, and so endlessly trying to make up for that. There was just a lack of confidence in Gore that led to, he just simply couldn't see the world without without these goggles on, these Gore Vidal goggles, which were very narrow. Needless to say, I don't mean to put him down, because he was a brilliant writer in his own way. And, you know, he still did write two or three really fine novels, you know, Julian is a terrific novel. Burr is a terrific novel. Myra Breckinridge is quite an inventive piece of work. And his essays are often, you know, pieces, masterpieces of the genre. So, he, you know, he achieved quite a lot.
Yes. But when you talk about the act aspect of him.
Yes, right.
He was very present as a fixture on television. And he was, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was one of the early sort of pioneers among writers and intellectuals to make use of television as a medium. Is that true?
Yeah, I'd say he was almost the first one, and he was in many ways the best of them. I mean, he came of age just when television came of age. I mean, he was a young man when TV was getting going in the early 50s. And so he was perfect for TV. He was handsome. He was eloquent. He could think on his feet. And so the culminating moment was the Buckley debates 1968. And so those are still, you know, classic television. Can't beat it, really.
It's interesting because it is classic television. And I've gone back on YouTube and watched all those debates. And I know other people have, even before the Best of Enemies documentary about it. Was that something that he returned to psychologically often, as has been said, that he would replay the clips of the debate?
Yeah, I mean, Gore would endlessly replay the debates, even quite literally, and I watched them with him many times. Gore was completely fascinated by Gore Vidal, and you know, when he was dying at his house in the Hollywood Hills, I was with him out there. And he had up on a big TV over his hospital bed, and somebody had brilliantly put together a string of Gore Vidal interviews, and they replayed all 24/7. Gore would be standing, looking there as he was dying, at tapes of himself dying, of himself on television.
Oh wow, that is just a very. Poetic image of a man on his deathbed 24/7 watching clips of himself on television.
Yes. Yeah. Remember he once said to me, never lose an opportunity to have sex or be on television.
Mm. And those two things are, I suppose, both related somehow psychologically in his mind.
In his mind they were, maybe not in your mind or my mind, but in his mind they were.
You mentioned The Last Station and the end of Tolstoy's life, and at the end of Gore's life,
yeah.
two very different men and two very different writers, but there is at the end seemingly a frustration. Do you think that both those guys, but I guess Gore in particular, died unhappy?
Oh yeah, Gore died unhappy, that's for sure. Felt that he was never really given his due as a writer, that he had faded already. He was really deeply worried about his reputation, and he used to always talk about the great eraser, which he said was at work trying to obliterate him and his reputation. So he'd say, the great eraser is at work again, Jay. I don't like it. Whereas, you know, Tolstoy was an enlightened spiritual creature. And he had this painful relationship with his wife, and everything went to hell in a handbasket at the very end. But, you know, Tolstoy was not worried about his reputation as a writer. Tolstoy was, you know, probably, in my view, the greatest novelist who ever wrote. I mean, Anna Karenina is a sublime work of art. War and Peace is pretty high up there. Yeah. Death of Ivan Illich is quite remarkable.
Do you, at the end of Tolstoy's life, why did you find that period interesting to write about?
Well, I remember I was living in southern Italy and reading a lot of Tolstoy. And I was in a bookshop in Naples, and I stumbled upon the diaries of this young mid 20-year-old guy who had worked as Tolstoy's personal secretary in the last year of his life. The guy's name was Valentin Fedorovich Bulgakov. And I read this and thought, oh my God. And he mentioned that everybody around Tolstoy was keeping diaries. And I got my hands, I wrote to the Tolstoy Society in London and got copies of Sophia Tolstoy's diaries, Leo Tolstoy's diaries, Tolstoy's doctor, Dushan Makovitsky, kept diaries. Tolstoy's daughter, Sasha, kept diaries. Everybody was keeping diaries. And so suddenly I had like 10 diaries, all cataloging the events of the final year of Tolstoy's life. And I thought, oh my God, this is a found novel. This is like unbelievable study and perspective. And that's what it, and then I saw it instantly that I had my, had a novel, and I rewrote the diaries. I used them as the model for The Last Station.
How do you approach that as a writer when you're taking something that really happened and turning it into a work of fiction?
Well, you know, anything that's processed by memory is fiction. So I'm just looking for the contours of something, trying to find an aesthetic shape that's going to be satisfying and is going to somehow bring out what might be the truth. But truth is very subjective. And in fact, I always thought with The Last Station, you get at truth, but the truth by layering many perspectives.
And that's when you talk about a book like Anna Karenina, because that's one of my favorite books too. But
yeah,
do you think a book like that could even not just succeed today, but be written today?
Well, you know, Tolstoy was able to write with an authoritative third-person viewpoint there, right? And I think that the world has shifted enough in the post, especially after postmodernism. It'd be very hard to write a book like Anna Karenina now. I think it's of its piece, of its place. Just like you probably couldn't write The Tempest now. You know, you couldn't Shakespeare. You couldn't have a dramatist come along and write a Shakespeare play. Those books arise out of the time and place. And I think Anna Karenina arises out of a particular class, upper class society in Russia in the mid 19th century. And so things are different now.
But even so, like you mentioned the rise of postmodernism, and there's been, I don't know that much about it, but I've heard scuttlebutt about people saying that it's thrown literature off course or made it, you know, like Harold Bloom would be a guy, you know, the critic who really railed against it. Is there anything, do you think, that's valid about that?
You know, it's just nostalgia for the past. You can never go back there again, right?
Yeah.
You can't go back and have, you can't go back and write Anna Karenina again. And so, yeah, I think you can value great works of the past, but you have to work out of your own perspective. And we now live we're in the postmodernist age, you know? And, you know, that's why I wrote the novel about Walter Benjamin called Benjamin's Crossing. It's one of the films I'm just finishing up the last version of the script now. And that was a novel about Walter Benjamin, who was really one of the earliest, postmodern thinkers. And, you know, he really did think hard about the manipulation of perspective and how truth is very difficult to get at, and how we, in many ways, we create our own truths. I'm very excited. I mean, I think of Borges and Me, that book of mine, as really a work of auto-fiction. You know what I'm saying? I'm aware of the fact, as I was writing it, I was acutely aware of the fact that even though it really happened, I'm shaping the reality that happened. You know?
Of course. Yeah, and especially when you're quoting dialogue or anything along those lines. And,
yeah.
You know.
I wasn't carrying a tape recorder. I didn't have it. So it's 50 years ago. So I'm having to invent the dialogue.
On that similar note, with the rise of sites like Twitter, where thought is necessarily limited by like a character count. And part of the reason why I bring up Anna Karenina is not just the cultural context, but its length. Do you think that this, quick fix attention span that we've all been, had our heads dunked in every time we open up our phone. Do you think that's affected literature?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, it's become very difficult. Fewer and fewer people are capable of actually reading a long novel and have the brain synapses and the kind of brain muscle that you need, you know, to sink into a book like that and to experience it in its full glory. We're used to short takes. You know, people nowadays read, 100 articles a day, but they're all about 200 words. And so they've simply killed off a part of their mind that enables them to properly read a great work.
Do you ever, when you're writing, think about that and sort of lose hope and go, oh my God, why people, if I write a 900 page book, how many people are really going to wrap their minds around it?
Well, I guess I'm aware of it in the sense that, like with Borges and me, I tried to write a book that's very, 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 very readable. One of the interviewers I talked with, Michael Silverblatt on NPR, and he said to me, oh, it's not even like reading, it's like gliding. And I tried to write a book that was just so easy to read, yet still sophisticated, but, you know, aiming it for readers who are not readers. I was trying for that. I had that in mind.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, as a poet, poetry seems like a very, unlike novel writing, very spontaneous or requires some kind of inspiration. Do you sit down or have a fixed schedule when writing poetry?
No, I could never do that. But, you know, I get the itch to write a poem pretty regularly. And so my notebook is always at hand. And so, you know, when I have an idea, I used to be more systematic about it. Nowadays, it's more sporadic, but it's regular. I mean, I'm writing a lot of poetry these days. And so, you know, I'm so used to writing poetry. And often at nighttime, I find I don't sleep very well. And so I wake up with ideas for poems. And I'm always, it's so annoying. I hate this. I have to go off into the room next door and put the light on and write down certain lines. So because I really won't remember them in the morning. So, and again, the audience for poetry is minuscule. And so, and it's a bit like the higher math. I mean, how many people are really able to do the higher math
right, in
any real way? So, you know, the people who are really writing and reading poetry at a pretty high level are pretty far and few between.
Do you think that there's, for aspiring writers, when you talk about, oh, the audience for, you know, really, you know, serious or great poetry is relatively small compared to, especially like a big social media platform like TikTok, where the content you're getting is so shallow. Do you think you just can't think about those things, that it's more just focusing on the work itself?
Oh yeah, I don't think about that stuff. I mean, you just have to say, I mean, I've had 50 or more years of working on poetry, and I have my own sense of what it is and what it should be and can be. And I have my own ambitions for my poetry, and I have my own, why I'm doing it is my own reasons. So that can't be shifted at this point. You know, and I've known some really great poets in my life, and I've watched how they worked. You know, I knew Seamus Heaney very well. I knew Robert Penn Warren. There's a truly great writer and a very modest man. One of the greatest people I ever met was Robert Penn Warren.
Why is that?
Do you know who he is?
I'm aware of him, and I think I've read a few of his poems.
He wrote great poetry. Robert Penn Warren won the Pulitzer Prize in 1946 for the greatest political novel ever written. It's called All the King's Men.
Yes.
Twice made into a movie. Once in 1949 was made into an Academy Award Best Picture, All the King's Men. He wrote, you know, a long shelf of novels. He wrote endless essays. And he wrote poetry and poetic dramas. He was an extraordinary mind. He won the Pulitzer Prize, I believe, three times. That's right, three-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He was an extraordinary man. He was America's first official poet laureate. He died in 1989, and I knew him very well. I used to go for hikes with him here in Vermont. And I last 10 years of his life, I had New Year's Eve with him, and I knew him extremely well. And he was kind and open and interested in young people, and his mind was endlessly fresh to the very end. And you know, he really, again, no one reads him much anymore, although All the King's Men keeps coming back. That will never go out of circulation because it's a truly great piece of work. But I guess the rest of his novels have evaporated into the thin air.
That's got to be a weird feeling, having known that guy and respected him so much, and then seeing that great eraser.
Well, yes, it's true. And, you know, but he's there in the history books. He really was something. And, you know, his poems, his greatest poems are going to, I think people will return to them again and again, if they return to poetry at all. You know, he was, you know, writing remarkable poetry at the end of his life. And he was, to me, he was a great inspiration to me, Robert Penn Warren.
What was Seamus Heaney like?
Well, I knew Seamus from the time he was in his, you know, I think I met him when he was like 30 years old. And I went over and stayed with him in Ireland when I was, you know, myself about 21. And he was, again, a very, very kind man, open, easy to be with, no pretenses at all. Everybody loved Seamus. He was, you know, just a very, very, very easygoing, open man. And also tremendous fun to listen to because he had a way of hanging words together that was quite unique. And just his everyday conversation was, you know, like, to me, it felt like poetry. And, you know, he was a really, you know, marvelous original poet with a vision. I mean, those poems are, to me, I mean, the part of the fabric of my mind.
And you knew him when he was young, and obviously he's passed away. You talked about Robert Penn Warren having that clarity of mind, even late in life. You also just mentioned that you've been at it writing for something like 50 years. Do you, what is your relationship to your own personal feeling of how creative you can be as the years go on?
I don't see there's any, I don't myself feel any diminishment. I feel like I'm every time I sit down to write a poem, I'm like a beginner. And I love that sensation of the page is blank, it's white. How will I write this? The fact that I've got some experience behind me is really, really good, can help me. I've got something of a voice that's evolved over the years, but it's really, I really always feel like every time I sit down to write, I feel like I'm about to write a really great poem. It'll be the best expression I can come up with for what I want to say in the moment. I mean, that's all you're really trying to do. And I have no pretensions about it. I almost don't give a shit about whether anybody reads me after I'm dead or reads me at all. It's about, the poetry is about, finding, putting feelings into words, right? It's about finding a language adequate to my experience. And if I do that, I feel like I've succeeded. That's what that's all about.
Well, what do you think is the place of poetry in today's world?
Well, you know, unfortunately, there are enough people out there that seem to find solace in poetry, that find it interesting, that find it, you know, worth reading. So people go back to, you know, I'm just today was in correspondence with somebody about Robert Frost and why we go back and read Frost. And, you know, these, the great poets, Frost, Wallace Stevens, you know, one goes back to them, Walt Whitman, because they are just endless sources of, they really define reality in ways that nothing else really does in quite the same way. Again, Frost really defined reality for me in certain ways. Well, you know, I live here, I've lived for 45 years in Northern New England, in Frost country. And so when I just drive around or go for a walk in the woods, as I do almost every day, I'm walking through Robert Frost poetry. And I look around me and I can just feel those poems. They just vibrate in my body. You know, the woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. I mean, these Frost poems stay in my head.
And it might've been slightly before your time. I can't remember when he died, but did you ever get a chance to meet him?
No. Frost died in what, 63? Okay. I was in junior and I was like a seventh grade when he died.
Okay.
So I was living in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I would have had no chance to meet Robert Frost. I wished I had.
I wish so too. I'm apparently in some weird way, my grandma was a Frost. So
oh, really? Wow.
It's in your blood. My blood. That's why I had to bring it up. No. The last question I wanted to ask you, because I don't want to take up too much of your time here, but as a novelist, a poet, but also as someone who's written a number of biographies, do you ever get a weird feeling writing about other writers? Like, you know, maybe I shouldn't say this because you can put yourself in their shoes of saying, you know, someone might go digging through my past someday and write a biography about me.
Yeah, no, I'm acutely aware of that. And many a time writing about, I've written on John Steinbeck, William Faulkner, Gore Vidal. I've written so many books, you know, about people. And so, yeah, I'm very hesitant sometimes to dig into certain areas. You know, you have to say enough without saying too much sometimes, right? I mean, with William Faulkner, I was hesitant to go into his drinking, which was pretty horrendous. So I had to give suggestions of it without, you know, I didn't want to spend all my time on that. With Gore Vidal, it was very awkward because he was a close friend. I didn't want to diss him. Didn't want to do him in. Didn't want to let my own occasional prejudices, for and against them, get in the way of a fairly clear-eyed examination of his work and his life, his place in American letters. It's tricky. Biography is a very delicate operation.
I think you've succeeded, though. I've taken a lot of pleasure in reading your books, and thank you very much for your time. Is there anything you want to plug before we go?
No, that's all great. I mean, thank you for inviting me onto your podcast, and I hope that it goes well for you.
Thank you very much. All right, Jay, good talking to you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you to Jay Perini, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.